I want you to just imagine a glass of water for a second.
It's just a standard glass of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just sitting there on your table. I mean, it seems incredibly simple, right? Like,
yeah.
It's just this passive background medium. It's the stage where all the actual, you know, interesting chemical reactions of life are supposed to happen.
That is definitely the traditional view, yeah.
But the crazy thing is, as you listen to this right now, there is this fierce, honestly, paradigm-shifting war happening. Like, right now, in the worlds of physics and biology, over what that water actually does the moment it touches the surface.
Really is a profound conflict. I mean, we are looking at a fundamental disagreement about the actual ontology of water itself.
Right.
Are we dealing with just a passive solvent? Or are we looking at something that is an active participant in the physical constitution of living systems?
And that is exactly what we are getting into today. We are doing a deep dive into a 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bachara Sahaly.
Yes, titled From the Fourth Phase to the Living Interface.
Right. And our mission today is to, to navigate this intense scientific controversy. We want to find out if water is actually this active architect of biological life and, you know, basically give you a shortcut to being the absolute most well-informed person in the room on this topic.
Which is going to require synthesizing decades of, frankly, very conflicting information.
Oh, absolutely.
We need to spot the hidden patterns here.
Yeah.
And explore not just what this new model of water is, but why it could completely redefine how we understand human health,
yeah,
and biology, and even the fundamental definition of a living system.
Okay, so to really grasp the magnitude of the debate here, we have to start with the core mystery. The thing that kicked off this entire scientific war.
The exclusion zone.
Exactly, or the EZ for short. And this is a phenomenon observed in the laboratory that just completely baffled people.
The foundational empirical claim here is pretty striking, and it really traces back to experiments that were popularized by Gerald Pollack and his colleagues right around 2006.
And the setup for this is deceptively simple, isn't it?
Very simple.
Mm-hmm.
You take a specific polymer called Nafion.
Right, Nafion.
Chemistically speaking, Nafion is a heavily fluorinated ionomer.
Okay, let's unpack that a little for everyone.
Sure. Think of a backbone that's very similar to Teflon.
Like the non-stick pan stuff?
Exactly. So it's highly hydrophobic, it repels water, and it's very chemically resistant. But it has these side chains attached to it that terminate in sulfonic acid groups.
So you basically have a material that is, on one hand, simultaneously water-repelling on its main structural backbone, but then it's incredibly water-loving or, you know, hydrophilic at these very specific charged terminal points.
Precisely. And those sulfonic acid groups are highly acidic. Which means when you place this Nafion into water, they readily dissociate.
Meaning they just shed protons?
Right. They dump protons into the surrounding water, which leaves the surface of the Nafion itself with a really strong negative charge.
Okay, so you have this negatively charged surface sitting in water.
Yes. And now here is the crucial part of the experiment. They place this Nafion in water that was heavily seeded with these tiny suspended tracer particles.
Like microscopic spheres, right?
Usually microscopic polystyrene spheres, yes.
And the bizarre observation is what happens literally right next to the surface.
It really is bizarre.
A massive gap just appears.
Mm-hmm.
Right next to the Nafion surface. The suspended particles are just completely pushed away, and it leaves this visually empty particle-depleted zone.
And the scale is what makes this so highly contentious.
Right, because we aren't talking about, you know, a hydration shell that's just a few water molecules thick.
No, not at all. This gap can extend for tens and sometimes hundreds of micrometers.
Which, I mean, let's be clear, on a molecular scale, hundreds of micrometers is astronomical.
It's massive. Standard physical chemistry strongly predicts that surface interactions, things like electrostatic repulsion or the structuring of dipole water molecules against a charged surface,
yep,
those effects should decay within just a few nanometers.
So to see a particle-free zone extending macroscopic distances into the bulk water, I mean, it completely defies all standard expectations of water just being a passive solvent.
Completely.
It's basically like, okay, think of the Nafion surface like a VIP bouncer at a really crowded club.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Right. It's somehow creating this massive, totally empty space around it where absolutely no regular patrons, you know, the tracer particles, are allowed to enter.
Exactly. The sheer undeniable reality of this massive empty zone, you can literally see it under a microscope, that is what led to the formulation of Model B.
Right. This is Dr. Pollack's theory, and it is radical.
Very radical. He suggested that the reason these particles are excluded is because the water right next to the surface has fundamentally changed its state.
He called it a fourth phase of water.
Yes. The proposition is that we are no longer dealing with regular bulk liquid water, but it's also not exactly solid ice either.
It's something else entirely.
Model B posits this highly structured, charge-separated, crystalline-like state. The hypothesis is that the water molecules actually align into a massive hexagonal lattice. And this lattice physically prevents solutes and particles from entering.
Because it's literally a physical wall of structured water.
That's the claim. And furthermore, they propose that this structuring process actively separates charge. It creates a region of negative electrical potential near the surface and a dense proton-enriched zone that gets pushed further out into the bulk liquid.
The white paper refers to this as Pollock's Copernican proposition, which I love because it really highlights the stakes here.
It does. A Copernican reversal completely changes the organizing center of a whole system.
Exactly. Because in biology, we usually model DNA and proteins and molecular motors as the isolated actors doing all the actual mechanical work. Mm-hmm. And water is just acting as the empty vacuum of space that they happen to float in.
But Model B proposes exactly the opposite for biology.
Yeah.
It suggests water is a central active participant. If water really forms macroscopic charge-separating structures in response to surfaces and environmental energy, then it is physically constituting the architecture of life, right alongside the lipid membranes and the proteins.
But, this is a big but, the white paper is really careful to introduce a major caveat here.
A very necessary caveat.
The visual phenomenon, this massive zone that is just completely devoid of particles, that is independently verified. Multiple labs around the world have replicated that.
Yes, the gap is real.
But observing that particles are missing from a specific region is entirely different from proving the actual existence of a macroscopic water crystal.
Exactly. Yeah. The burden of proof for declaring a brand new phase of matter is exceptionally high.
As it should be.
To definitively prove a fourth phase that is hundreds of micrometers thick, you need a unique, tracer-independent molecular signature.
Meaning you can't just rely on watching the little plastic spheres run away.
Right. You would need highly specific spectroscopic data showing a distinct phase boundary between this supposed structured water and the regular bulk water.
And we don't have that.
Well, while there are some subtle optical differences, a definitive macroscopic phase transition signature of that magnitude has simply not been established to the satisfaction of the broader physics community.
Which naturally opens the door wide open for the skeptics.
It certainly does.
Because if we don't have undeniable proof that the water is miraculously turning into a giant ice-like lattice, we have to look for, you know, normal physics reasons why those particles are fleeing the surface.
And this leads us to what the paper calls Model A.
The transport dominant account.
Right. Investigators like Floria, Esplandio, and Schur, they examined the exact same Naphian experiments and just applied fundamental transport physics.
The cold, hard math.
Exactly. They pointed out that we do not need to invent a novel phase of water to explain a particle-depleted zone.
Because the answer is actually in the Naphian itself.
But the key lies in what Naphian actually does chemically.
Mm-hmm.
As we noted earlier, it is a highly active ion exchanger.
So it's dumping those protons into the water and simultaneously scavenging positive ions, or cations, from the surrounding solution.
Yes, and here's where the physics of diffusion takes over. You see, ions do not move through water at the same speed.
Okay, this is a huge point. Walk us through that.
Well, think about a proton. It is essentially just a bare hydrogen nucleus. It has an exceptionally high mobility in water compared to, say, a bulky sodium or potassium ion.
Because it's so tiny.
Exactly. So when the Naphian dumps these really fast-moving protons outward and simultaneously pulls the slow-moving cations inward, you get a massive disparity in how the charge is distributed in the water.
Oh, I see. Because the positive and negative charges are physically moving at vastly different speeds, you get this huge separation of charge in the fluid itself.
Precisely. And that separation of charge generates a very strong, localized electric field.
And alongside that electric field, you also have intense chemical concentration gradients extending really far out from the surface, right?
Yes. And the critics, these transport physicists, they mathematically modeled these exact fields.
And what did they find?
They demonstrated that the tracer particles are subjected to two known physical forces. Diffusiophoresis, meaning the particles are just being pushed along by the chemical concentration gradients.
Okay.
And electrophoresis, meaning they're being driven away by the generated electrical field.
So under Model A, the particles aren't hitting some invisible physical wall of structured ice water.
Not at all.
They are just caught in a microscopic rip current that's being generated by this unequal ion exchange.
That is exactly their argument.
But wait, if the critics have the math to prove that the particles are just riding an electrical wave, doesn't that completely kill the fourth phase theory? I mean, why are we even talking about this if Model A solves the mystery?
That's a very fair question. The mathematical precision of Model A is remarkably robust. They demonstrated that if you calculate the strength of these generated fields, it perfectly predicts the size and the behavior of the exclusion zone.
So it feels like a classic case of applying Occam's razor. Why do we need to look any further than classical physics?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the white paper points out a logical flaw in stopping there. Explaining the localized mechanism of how a particle moves is not identical to explaining the full ontology of the environment it's moving through.
Okay, break that down for me.
The transport equations are purely descriptive. They detail the feed-forward consequence of the ion exchange. They take the gradients as a given input to calculate the output, which is particle velocity.
So they describe the push, but perhaps they don't fully capture the actual system that's doing the pushing.
Exactly. Dr. Sedili's paper argues that Model A and Model B are actually locked in a false binary.
Like they're arguing over two sides of the same coin.
Yes. The transport physicists say it's just currents, while the structuralists say, no, it's a static crystal.
And the paper says they might both be half right. Which brings us to the synthesis, Model C.
The emergent non-equilibrium interface model.
That is a mouthful. Let's call it Model C.
Model C works perfectly. This framework suggests that isolating these variables, like looking at just the surface chemistry or just the ion gradients or just the water dynamics, fundamentally misses the reality of how they all behave together.
So the core premise of Model C is that these elements are reciprocally coupled.
Yes, reciprocally coupled.
Meaning the ion exchange isn't just happening in the water. The resulting gradients and the electrical polarization of the water molecules are actively maintaining each other. It's a dynamic organization.
To really clarify the distinction between Model A and Model C, the paper uses an excellent analogy regarding electrical circuits.
Oh, right, the battery analogy. I loved this part.
It's very helpful. Model A, which provides the transport equations, is analogous to describing the current running through a wire.
Right.
It accurately tells you the flow rate, the resistance, and the work being done by the current. But detailing the current running through the circuit does not explain the internal structural architecture of the battery that is actually generating and regulating the voltage.
So Model A maps the circuit, but Model C is basically attempting to reverse engineer the battery itself.
Precisely. And to build that framework, the paper leverages Terence Deacon's constraint theory.
Which, I'll be honest, this required a slight shift in how I usually think about cause and effect.
It does for most people. We typically look for positive forces in physics, a push or a pull. But Deacon argues for the concept of absence doing work.
Absence doing work. It sounds almost philosophical.
It sounds paradoxical, but it's a vital concept for understanding biological organization. A constraint does not add energy to a system. It removes possibilities.
Okay, give me an example of that.
Consider the geometry of a biological structure, such as the lumen of a blood vessel.
Okay, so a tube, basically.
Right. The physical boundary of the vessel walls restricts the degrees of freedom for the fluid inside. The blood cannot diffuse outward in all directions. It is physically forced to move directionally.
So by removing possibilities, meaning the blood can't go sideways, the system forces the gradients to become directionally productive.
Yes. The physical absence of material in the center, which is strictly bounded by the walls, channels random thermodynamic fluctuations into productive work.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. The interface isn't a thing you can hold, right? It's a relationship.
Exactly. Model C proposes that the hydrated interface is a non-equilibrium organization.
Like a whirlpool.
A whirlpool is the perfect way to visualize this.
Because you can observe a whirlpool in a river, you can measure its dimensions, you can even calculate its rotational force. But the whirlpool isn't made of some physically distinct, crystallized form of water.
No, it's just regular water.
It only exists as a dynamic pattern because of the constant flow of kinetic energy interacting with the physical constraints of the rocks in the riverbed.
And if you stop the flow of the river, or if you remove the rocks,
The structure vanishes instantly. The whirlpool is just gone.
Exactly. A whirlpool is an emergent, dynamically maintained interface. And Model C argues that the exclusion zone is a microscopic analog to that whirlpool. It is an organization maintained by the constant flow of energy, the ion exchange, and the physical constraint of the surface. It is a process, not a static substance.
Okay, but this raises a huge, obvious question. If this beautifully complex, dynamically coupled interface actually exists, why on earth is it so hard to see?
The observability problem.
Right. I mean, if water is behaving as this dynamically organized system at biological interfaces, why hasn't science just definitively mapped this by now? Why is there even a debate?
Because, historically, our methods for observing biological structure fundamentally destroy the very relationships we are attempting to measure.
Which brings us to the story of the interstitium.
Yes, the 2018 Benaya study. It is a perfect historical mirror for the problem we're discussing.
This story blew my mind. So for centuries, our entire understanding of human connective tissue was based on doctors looking at slides under a microscope.
Standard histology.
Right. You take a tissue sample, you dehydrate it, you fix it with these really harsh chemicals, you slice it incredibly thin, and then you look at what's left.
And under those specific conditions, pathologists observed dense, tightly packed bands of collagen.
So the scientific consensus for literally hundreds of years was that this tissue was just a solid, relatively dry structural barrier in the body.
But the 2018 study changed the methodology. They didn't look at dead, dehydrated, chemically fixed slides.
No, they looked at living tissue.
They used probe-based confocal laser endomicroscopy to examine the tissue in living patients utilizing fluorescent markers.
And what they found completely overturned centuries of anatomy textbooks, because those dense, solid bands of collagen, they weren't solid at all.
Not in the living state, no.
In the living hydrated state, they were actually this massive, wide-open, fluid-filled network. But the fluid literally just drained away, and the delicate structural lattice just collapsed in on itself the moment the tissue was excised and prepared for a standard slide.
The perceived solid structure was an artifact of the preparation method. We were observing the wreckage of the system, not the living architecture.
It's exactly like looking at a collapsed tent on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, just a flat pile of canvas and some disconnected poles, and confidently concluding that the structure was always just a flat tarp.
That is a brilliant analogy.
Because by removing the tension in the air, you completely miss the actual architecture of the tent.
And this historical oversight provides a crucial methodological rule for testing Model C. The white paper explicitly states a new rule for this field. Preserve the relations first, perturb them second, dissect them last.
Because you cannot study the organization of a whirlpool by scooping it into a plastic bucket and driving it back to the lab.
Exactly. The moment you isolate the water in a bucket, the organization is completely gone.
Right.
If you utilize standard biochemical techniques, if you dry a sample out or introduce harsh chemical buffers or homogenize the tissue in a centrifuge, you instantly destroy the dynamic relationship between the water, the ions, and the surface.
You end up just studying the flat tarp again.
Precisely. So to actually evaluate Model C, we require advanced, non-destructive analytical techniques capable of observing molecular behavior in situ in its natural environment.
And the paper delves into the specifics of these crazy advanced tools like time-resolved, heterodyne-detected vibrational sum frequency generation.
Yes.
I'm going to need you to explain how exactly a tool with a name that long allows us to observe the interface without destroying it.
It sounds intimidating, but the principle is elegant. It is a nonlinear optical technique designed specifically for looking at interfaces.
Okay.
You overlap two different laser pulses, usually one visible and one infrared, precisely at the surface you want to study.
Okay, so shooting two lasers at a surface.
Now, the key physical principle here is that the sum frequency signal, the specific light reflecting back that we measure, is only generated in environments where the molecular symmetry is broken.
Meaning it just completely ignores the bulk liquid water, because those molecules are just randomly pointing in all directions.
Exactly. In the bulk water, the random orientations of the molecules cancel each other out optically, so no signal is generated. But right at the interface, if the water molecules are structurally aligned because of the surface constraints and the electrical fields we discussed, their symmetry is broken.
So the lasers only see the structured water.
Right. The lasers generate a unique signal that tells us exactly how those specific interfacial water molecules are oriented and how tightly they are hydrogen bonded, all without physically disturbing the system at all.
That is incredible. And the paper pairs this with studies using stimulated Raman excited fluorescence. They highlight a 2024 study by Lang and colleagues.
Yes, the Lang study is pivotal.
They utilized this Raman microspectroscopy on actual living cells, and they found that roughly 3% of the intracellular water exhibits a non-bulk-like spectrum.
And that 3% metric is highly significant for resolving this debate.
Why is 3% the magic number?
Well, it definitively counters the most extreme interpretations of Model B.
Right, the fourth phase theory.
Because some structuralists imply that vast swaths of cellular water, maybe even all of it, are in a rigid crystalline state. 3% shows it's a localized phenomenon.
Okay, but it's not a win for Model A either, right?
Exactly. It simultaneously challenges the pure Model A assumption that water is entirely passive.
Because 3% is still a huge amount of molecules doing something very specific.
It confirms that a small but structurally distinct fraction of water is heavily constrained by biological interfaces. It is behaving differently than bulk water.
But the question remains, is that 3% just a passive byproduct of the surface chemistry, or is it an active participant in an emergent system?
And to break the deadlock between these competing paradigms, Dr. Seeley's paper proposes something really refreshing, an adversarial collaboration.
I love this concept. So this is a framework where competing factions, the structuralists of Model B and the transport physicists of Model A, they actually have to sit down and co-design an experiment together.
It really is the most rigorous form of scientific inquiry. The factions must agree on the strongest possible iterations of each other's theories. They have to steelman each other's arguments.
Which never happens on the internet, so it's nice to see it in science.
Right. And crucially, they must pre-register the experiment, meaning they publicly state exactly what specific empirical evidence would falsify their own hypothesis before a single data point is collected.
No moving the goalposts after the fact.
Exactly.
And the paper actually outlines specific tests for this ultimate showdown. The first one is called gradient neutralization.
Yes, this directly tests the core claim of Model A.
Because if Model A claims that the massive exclusion zone is entirely 100% driven by chemical concentration gradients and the resulting electrical fields, the test is to just artificially flatline those gradients.
The methodology they propose involves highly sophisticated microfluidics.
Yeah.
You observe the exclusion zone forming around the Naphion under a microscope, and then you introduce highly specific counterions into the water to perfectly clamp and neutralize the chemical gradients in real time.
You essentially just kill the voltage and perfectly balance the salt concentrations.
Exactly.
So if you clamp the gradients and the empty zone instantly collapses, like the tracer particles immediately rush right back to the surface of the plastic, then Model A is overwhelmingly validated.
Right. The transport physicists would win. It would prove the exclusion zone was purely a mechanical rip current generated by the unequal ions.
But if the gradients are clamped and a significant structurally distinct particle-free phase just remains robustly intact, sitting there, then Model B is validated.
Yes. It would prove that the structured crystalline phase exists independently of the active transport gradients.
But what about Model C? I mean, what constitutes a win for the emergent interface theory, since it's supposed to be a dynamic coupling of both?
Model C anticipates a very specific behavior, a delayed hysteretic decay.
Hysteretic decay. Okay, what does that look like under the microscope?
If the gradients are neutralized, you wouldn't see an instant collapse like Model A predicts, nor would you see a permanently robust phase like Model B predicts. You would observe the outer edges of the zone collapsing immediately, while an inner core of organized water slowly, gradually dissolves over time.
Oh, because it exhibits a physical memory of the dynamic state it was just in.
Exactly. The structure requires the flow of gradients to be maintained, but the water itself possesses an organized cohesion that actually takes time to unravel once the energy flow stops.
That is so cool. Now, there is a second critical test proposed in the paper, and this one is about light versus heat.
This one is fascinating.
Because Model B proponents, the fourth phase camp, they claim that if you hit the water with specific wavelengths of infrared light, it dramatically expands the exclusion zone. Like, it grows massively.
Yes. They hypothesize that the water is actively absorbing radiant light energy to build more of the crystalline lattice.
But the transport critics, the Model A camp, they provide a much simpler physical explanation.
They do. They point out that infrared light is fundamentally thermal energy. It heats the water.
And when you increase the temperature of a fluid, you alter the diffusion coefficients of the ions moving through it.
Right. The critics argue the light isn't building a biological crystal. It is simply accelerating the transport kinetics.
It's effectively just turning up the flow rate on the diffusiophoresis, like turning up a pump.
Exactly. So the adversarial test they designed to separate these two specific mechanisms is brilliant.
Yeah, walk us through this.
First, you introduce the infrared light, and you utilize high-resolution thermal imaging to map the exact three-dimensional heat signature that is generated in the test chamber.
So you know exactly how hot every micrometer of the water gets.
Right. Then you turn the light off, you remove the light source entirely.
Okay.
Next, you introduce a localized heating element, a physical probe designed to perfectly recreate that exact same three-dimensional thermal map in the water, but strictly through conductive heat, completely devoid of any radiant light.
Oh, that is so smart. It perfectly isolates the variable of radiant energy.
Yes. So if the exclusion zone expands identically under both the light and the pure heat control,
then the expansion is purely a thermal transport effect. The critics win that one.
But if the infrared light produces a massive structural expansion that the cure heat map cannot replicate,
then you have isolated a non-thermal state-specific response in the water itself. The light is actually doing something beyond just heating the water.
Exactly. These adversarial tests are rigorously designed to pinpoint whether we are observing a circuit, a static structure, or a dynamic battery.
Okay, so let's assume Model C survives this rigorous testing, that we are indeed looking at a reciprocally coupled dynamic interface.
A very safe assumption, given the current trajectory of the data.
The paper then pivots to the most critical translation because, you know, Nafion is a piece of synthetic plastic.
Yes, it is.
And you, listening to this, are a biological being. How do these principles actually translate to the overwhelming complexity of a living system?
It's the most important question. We cannot simply extrapolate an effect seen near a piece of plastic and loudly declare that every human cell has a giant exclusion zone around it. The translation requires identifying the true relational architecture at a biological scale. We have to look at biology's most critical boundaries.
And a primary example the paper uses is the inner mitochondrial membrane.
Yes, the site of oxidative phosphorylation and ATP production, the powerhouse of the cell, as everyone learns in high school.
Right, and the classical model here is Peter Mitchell's chemiosmotic hypothesis from the 1960s.
A Nobel Prize-winning theory.
Right, standard textbook biology. It says the mitochondria pump protons across their inner membrane, and that generates an electrochemical gradient. And then those protons basically flow back into the mitochondrial matrix through a protein called ATP synthase, and it physically turns the enzyme like a turbine to manufacture ATP.
And that classical model is effectively a biological manifestation of Model A physics.
Right, because it's a transport gradient doing mechanical work.
Exactly. However, Model C asks us to examine the specific physical constraints of that microenvironment. You see, the inner mitochondrial membrane is not a smooth, flat sphere.
No, it's all soldered up.
It is deeply invaginated into highly complex folds known as cristae.
And the structural constraint there is extreme. The space inside these folds is incredibly tight, and the membrane itself is densely packed with these protein complexes and a very specific cone-shaped lipid called cardiolipin.
And the cardiolipin is heavily concentrated right at the sharpest curves of these cristae.
Okay.
So Model C hypothesizes that this extreme physical curvature, combined with the unique charge distribution of that cardiolipin, dynamically structures the adjacent interfacial water.
Yeah.
The physical constraint of the geometry prevents the pump protons from simply diffusing randomly out into the bulk fluid of the mitochondria.
Instead, this highly organized interfacial water basically acts as a perfectly tuned proton wire.
Yes, a proton wire that rapidly channels the ions directly along the surface of the membrane straight to the ATP synthase complex.
So the architecture of the membrane doesn't just statically hold the water, it actively uses its own geometry to constrain the water into a highly conductive interface.
Exactly. It transforms the system from a basic transport gradient into a hyper-efficient, highly tuned, localized energy grid.
That is wild. And the paper doesn't just stop at mitochondria. It scales this concept up from the organelles inside the cell to the outer boundary of the entire cell itself.
Right. Focusing heavily on the glycocalyx.
Which is, let me make sure I have this right. The glycocalyx is this dense, brush-like layer of glycoproteins and glycolipids that basically coats the exterior of virtually all living cells.
That is correct. It is the literal physical interface between the living cell and its external environment.
And the paper highlights a very recent 2025 study by Shi and colleagues examining the endothelial glycocalyx specifically in the brain.
Yes, the lining of the microvessels that form the blood-brain barrier.
This study was intense. So they tracked what happens to this interfacial boundary as mice age, and they observed a very specific degradation. The mucin domain glycoproteins within the glycocalyx actually begin to break down as the mice get older.
And the structural consequence of that degradation is severe. As the glycocalyx thins out and loses its structural integrity, the blood-brain barrier becomes highly permeable. The biological boundary literally fails.
Which leads to neuroinflammation, which directly correlates with measurable cognitive decline and memory deficits in these aged mice.
But the transformative finding of the Shi study wasn't just observing the degradation happen.
Right, they didn't just watch them get worse.
No, they actively intervened. They selectively restored those specific core glycans in the aged mice.
They repaired the structural constraints of the interface.
Exactly. And by restoring the structural integrity of the glycocalyx, they effectively resealed the blood-brain barrier and rescued the memory deficits in the mice.
Which is huge, because it demonstrates that the glycocalyx is not a static, passive wall like a brick wall. It is an active, dynamic boundary.
Yes, the cell expends continuous, massive amounts of metabolic energy to synthesize those glycoproteins and maintain that highly hydrated, organized interfacial barrier.
Which bridges directly into what the paper frames as the defining characteristic of a living system in the first place.
Yes, leveraging Maturana and Varela's concept of autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis, which translates roughly to self-creation or self-maintenance.
Right. It defines a living system not by its specific constituent parts.
Yeah.
You know, not just a list of proteins and lipids, but by its organization.
Right.
A living system is a network of processes that continuously regenerates the very components that comprise the network. And most importantly, it dynamically maintains its own physical boundary against the chaotic environment.
Okay, let's contrast that with the Naphion plastic from the first experiment.
Great comparison.
A piece of Naphion placed in water will spontaneously generate a highly organized, complex exclusion zone based purely on its surface chemistry, right?
It will.
But Naphion is not alive. If you scratch the Naphion or if the sulfonic acid groups degrade over time, the polymer does not repair itself. It's just a one-way physical reaction.
Precisely. A biological cell, however, uses the energy generated by its internal processes to actively weave and repair the glycocalyx that defines its outer boundary.
It's constantly rebuilding the tent.
Exactly. Model C suggests that this reciprocally coupled interaction, the water, the ions, and the constantly renewed membrane structures, that is the actual material mechanism of autopoiesis.
The living interface is the physical realization of the boundary separating the living organism from the non-living environment.
It is what makes life, life.
Okay, so if the very definition of our biological state relies on the continuous maintenance of this delicate dynamic water interface, we have to deeply consider what happens when we introduce novel chemical perturbations into that environment.
We do. And this brings us to a highly charged area of the white paper. Toxins, stress, and the loss of resilience.
The paper navigates this really carefully, utilizing a 2018 study by Sharma and colleagues as a prime analytical case.
Yes. The study examined the effects of a commercial Roundup herbicide formulation on the exclusion zone generated by Naphion.
The classic glyphosate test case.
Right.
And the immediate observable result in that study was that exposure to the commercial herbicide significantly shrank the size of the exclusion zone. It just collapsed it.
It did. And it's very easy to look at that specific data and immediately leap to the conclusion that glyphosate fundamentally destroys the organized water structures in human biology.
It's the headline everyone would click.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But rigorous science demands that we deconstruct the variables.
Right.
The white paper explicitly cautions against overly simplistic interpretations of complex mixtures. A commercial herbicide like Roundup is not purely glyphosate acid.
Oh, not at all. It contains various salts, heavily concentrated surfactants, and proprietary adjuvants designed specifically to break down surface tension on plant leaves.
Precisely. So we have to ask, was the active ingredient responsible for collapsing the interface, or did the harsh industrial surfactants simply strip the surface chemistry off the Naphion?
Did it alter the pH? Did it introduce some massive osmotic shock that just completely overwhelmed the ion exchange mechanism?
We don't know from that simple test.
Right.
Without isolating those individual variables, you cannot pinpoint the precise mechanism of action.
But, and I think this is the brilliant part, the theoretical framework Model C builds around toxicology is far more nuanced than simply asking if a chemical outright destroys a structure.
It is. It distinguishes between an acute, direct injury that causes immediate cell death and a much more subtle loss of coherence.
Right. Because if we view the cell not as a rigid metal machine, but as a dynamic coupled whirlpool, then low dose exposure to environmental stressors might not act like dropping a massive boulder that instantly dams the river.
No, it acts as a weak perturbation.
A weak perturbation, meaning it might subtly alter the hydration shell of a protein or slightly flatten a local chemical gradient or just marginally disrupt the charge distribution on the membrane.
Exactly. And biological systems are incredibly robust. They're designed to compensate for variations.
Right.
If the interface experiences a weak perturbation, the cell will simply upregulate its metabolic processes to maintain its vital functions.
So the baseline output appears completely normal.
Yes. Standard toxicological assays, which often just measure immediate cell death or gross morphological changes, they will register that cell as perfectly healthy.
Because it's still doing its job.
Right. But beneath that normal output, the interface is working significantly harder just to maintain basic equilibrium.
The critical insight here is the concept of reserve capacity.
Precisely. The cell maintains its resting state, but it expends its interfacial reserve to do so. It loses its biological resilience, meaning its ability to dynamically adapt to a subsequent stressor.
It is highly analogous to driving a vehicle with a slightly slipping transmission.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Because if you are just cruising on flat ground at a steady speed, the car feels totally fine, the output matches your expectations, but the underlying mechanical coherence is secretly compromised.
Yes.
And the moment you introduce a secondary stressor, like maybe you try to tow a really heavy trailer, or you suddenly hit a steep incline, the transmission just catastrophically fails.
A loss of biological resilience operates on the exact same principle. An organism might be managing a chronic, low-level chemical perturbation perfectly well. It seems healthy.
Right.
But when exposed to a secondary stressor, say, a viral infection or acute psychological stress or physical trauma, the system suddenly lacks the dynamic reserve to adapt.
Because it was already redlining just to stay normal.
Exactly. What should have been a minor, easily resolved physiological challenge cascades into a chronic or severe illness because the coherence of the living interface was already degraded.
So Model C basically argues for a massive expansion in how we evaluate chemical safety.
Huge expansion.
We have to look way beyond acute toxicity and start developing tools to measure how environmental factors impact the dynamic relational coherence of our cellular boundaries over time.
Because that is where chronic illness actually begins.
Wow. Okay, let's take a breath and trace the full arc of what we've unpacked today, because it's huge.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
We started with a microscopic anomaly, just a bizarre empty gap appearing next to a piece of charged plastic.
The exclusion zone.
Right. And then we examined the intense debate between the mechanical physics of diffusiophoresis in Model A and the structural crystalline claims of Model B.
The false binary.
Exactly. Then we explored the elegant synthesis of Model C, the emergent non-equilibrium interface, which completely reframes the system as a dynamic reciprocal relationship between surfaces, ions, and water.
A relationship, not a substance.
And finally, we saw how that dynamic relationship serves as the actual physical architecture for life itself, from the proton-channeling cristae of our mitochondria to the memory-preserving glycocalyx in our brains.
And the real utility of a deep dive like this is practical application.
How so?
Well, when you, the listener, encounter news regarding cellular hydration or environmental toxicity or novel medical therapies, you now possess a far more rigorous critical framework.
Right. You're not just taking headlines at face value.
Exactly. You can analyze whether a claim relies on simplistic linear transport mechanisms or if it genuinely addresses the dynamic, organized interfaces that actually define biological resilience.
You are equipped to ask the harder questions. But to close this out, I want to pose a conceptual extrapolation that kind of pushes the boundaries of this entire framework.
I'm intrigued.
We've established that the physical distinction between the living state and non-living matter heavily relies on this precise, dynamically maintained coherence of water, charge, and structural constraints at the molecular level.
Yes, autopoiesis.
Right. So if our biological integrity is dictated by the memory and organization of these living interfaces, could this objective phenomenon of consciousness itself be fundamentally tied to the coherence of that exact state?
Oh, wow.
I mean, think about it. When we observe cognitive decline, like the breakdown of the blood-brain barrier causing memory deficits that we talked about earlier, is it merely a mechanical failure of neuronal wiring? Or is the profound, localized organization of water inside the brain intrinsically linked to our actual capacity to hold and process information? If the living interface is the physical substrate of life, is its highest level of coherence the physical substrate of the mind itself?
That is an extraordinarily provocative implication.
Right.
I mean, if the interfacial architecture is truly responsible for autopoiesis, mapping its relationship to cognition and consciousness is undeniably the next immense frontier in science.
A profound thought to carry with you the next time you look at a simple glass of water on your table. Keep questioning the paradigms, keep looking deeper, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.